Critical Theory in Context.
Welcome to Critical Theory in Context, the podcast of the Center for Social Critique at Humboldt University Berlin. I'm your host, Jacob Blumenfeld. And today we are talking about AI. Are you using it right now? Stop. Focus on my voice. I'm a real person. You're a real person. And today you'll hear a real conversation amongst four people and myself on why and how we should criticize AI as an ideology, as an infrastructure, and as a form of power. The discussion took place on February 16th at HU Berlin at an event I organized called Critique of AI with the guests Matteo Pasquinelli, Anna Verena Nostoff, Roland Meyer, and Raina Mulhoff. But before I play that conversation, I have in the studio now with me Robin Selikates, co-director of the Center for Social Critique, to introduce the conversation and the topic. Welcome, Robin.
Hi, Jacob.
So I just want to get your first impressions of the event and the conversation that followed.
Yeah. So, I mean, I thought it was a great conversation. I really learned a lot. I'm not super familiar with the whole AI discussion. And so, just listening to the panelists and you talk about how to criticize AI, the question of what exactly is wrong with AI to move beyond some of the rather superficial, you know, both critical and especially affirmative debates on AI that we're seeing in the public sphere, but also at university where, you know, a lot of people either reject it out of hand but don't really seem to have a deep analysis of it, or especially university leadership seem to embrace it in a way that is, super problematic. And I thought it was interesting to see that there was some kind of fundamental agreement that if we ask, well, what's wrong with AI? How do we criticize AI? We shouldn't merely be focusing on, let's say, AI's external effects on society, ecological effects, economic effects, political effects. Nor should we just focus on, which would, easily suggest itself, the really evil and politically damaging forces that at the current moment control AI. Mm-hmm. The big tech companies, their
CEOs,
the Thiels and Musks of this world. Yeah. But we have to understand that there's a deeper problem, as it were, with that technology. And, whether you spell it out in terms of ideology, as some of the speakers did, or whether you spell it out in terms of the appropriation and exploitation of social labor, collective intelligence, that is something that is kind of inscribed in or embedded in the technology itself. It's not just a matter of its abuse. It's not just a matter of its effects. It's really a matter of how that technology operates in the first place. So that was super interesting, I thought, and something where, a lot of follow-up questions obviously suggest themselves.
Yeah, and you could say maybe there was even sometimes a slight tension between a focus on AI as a kind of ideology, an ideology that replicates racial or like gendered biases in data sets and then imposes them on society at large through their outputs, or the ideology of transhumanism or effective altruism, or the different ideologies of the people who control the means of AI, versus thinking about AI as a continuation of the logic of capitalist kind of division of labor, automation, abstraction, reduction of labor time, higher exploitation. And this, you could say, it's kind of maybe independent of the ideology. It's just a deepening of tensions and tendencies that are already taking place in moments of capitalist crisis. And the question, there that maybe came up was, what's the difference between these two critiques? Are they in tension? Are they complementary? Mm. How do we think about them?
Yeah. No, I think it's, that was an interesting moment. And I thought in the end, it's kind of complementary in the sense of looking at the ideological ways of operating that some of the speakers thought a characteristic of AI really also means understanding how it is embedded in social reality, how it builds on, our knowledge, our capacities, our interactions, our self-understandings in ways that are then financialized, that are, extracted to a certain extent, and then operate in a way, also in the ways in which we are governed, and not just economically exploited, but really governed through new forms of power that are fundamentally and maybe constitutively intransparent and that don't really respond in the same ways to critique, contestation, you know, the demand for justification that we might be addressing to other forms of power that we are more used to and which critical theorists have kind of focused on. So I thought that was an interesting moment. But there seemed to be another tension maybe that emerged from the conversation where, you know, on the one hand, there was this agreement about the need for a kind of fundamental ideology critique of AI, again, not in terms of its effects or its abuses, but really of the kind of way this technology operates. But on the other hand, Rainer Mühlhoff made that point pretty forcefully, said that at the same time, it's kind of clear that you can't just reject that technology out of hand. I mean, it's kind of here to stay. Also, it has very different uses and manifestations, and some of them are worse than others. And so we need a kind of differentiated approach. And I was wondering what you make of that kind of call for differentiation, because, of course, from a kind of critical theory perspective, there is maybe this kind of totalizing drive towards seeing the technology as such. Mm-hmm. As the problem, and there are very important reasons to do that. And, you know, it's definitely the kind of critique I think that is at this point required and kind of underrepresented in public discourse. But at the same time, I see why some people might think, well, that's a bit maybe too easy. You know, we should really look in a more complex way at this kind of complex technology, its potential usages. Maybe it can be, you know, used for emancipatory purposes or at least democratically regulated in a way that isn't so bad. So I was wondering what you made of this kind of potential tension in the conversation.
Yeah, I mean, there seems to be a certain realism about the presence of AI and the plurality of uses that people have with it, right? It's different than using it to, exploit workers by making them by tracking their movements with surveillance technology, or to create images of like a nostalgic white hetero patriarchal past and then project those as, you know, the ideology of the future. There's differences in the use of AI for like, or climate modeling for pattern recognition or for like scientific breakthroughs. So maybe it makes sense to have a kind of a differentiated understanding of, you know, what are the improper and improper uses of AI without kind of fetishizing technology as somehow inherently evil, right? You don't want to fall into a technophobia or a technological pessimism. On the other hand, there might be an emancipatory use of artificial intelligence in the future, right? It might be a democratic form. But the one we have today is not that, right? The one we have today emerges from capital social relations and this lurch towards the far right, right? Which is embedded in a society moving towards militarization, more towards a kind of logic of fascism in its representation of the nation, and in kind of elimination of difference from the social body. And AI tools are emerging from this moment and replicating them, accelerating them, deepening them, and then using them to target individuals. Mm-hmm. And in that sense, it's hard to say we need to differentiate sometimes, right? Because you know, a fundamental critique would be like, no, we have to draw a line here, and maybe leave open the possibility for a different kind of AI in the future, like one that comes from different needs, maybe different kinds of ends, aesthetic ends, or ones that can coordinate economic processes without the market. Or I mean, you can imagine other uses of AI, but that's not the one we have. Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of where I feel is a difficulty of the conversation.
True. And I mean, again, if we think there's not just a kind of external, you know, affinity with fascist political projects, because some of the influential people seem to be fascists, but rather a kind of either inherent or at least kind of elective affinity between AI and fascist political projects, the question is, you know, can there be an emancipatory AI, or even, you know, could there be something like a project of socialization or democratization of AI, right? I mean, in its currently existing form, not in some kind of utopian abstract alternative that you can't yet imagine, but at this point. And that seems relevant as a form of the question that the panel also turned to, namely, well, what do we do now? You know, if we agree that we need this kind of fundamental critique of AI, we can't just focus on its superficial, although, you know, deeply harmful effects and the question of its abuse, the question is, well, what's the alternative? And it seems hard to avoid the kind of more Luddite rejection of AI if it's unclear what it whether it could be socialized or democratized. I mean, because socialization, democratization is not just a matter of, you know, can we have a bit more regulation? Yeah, we can, and we should push for that. Mm-hmm. Or could we have different, you know, ownership structures? Yeah, we should also do that. And there could be smaller scale, you know, community controlled, ecologically sustainable ways of having AI models, I guess. But there seems to be a problem with the way in which AI as a technology functions, right? Because it's proceeding, if I understood it correctly, from a predetermined data set, and then you have a problem and you have prompts, and then it generates a statistically optimized outcome and one output only that presents itself as the right answer to the question. Mm-hmm. And that's happening in a process that is fundamentally intransparent and in that respect constitutively different from other forms of political or social decision making, where at least in principle you can trace, contest, challenge, revise the decision making, even if, you know, states and other powerful entities are quite good at preventing that from happening. In principle it's possible, and political movements are doing this all the time. In the case of AI, simply because of the way in which an asylum claim is rejected, you know, protesters are identified for targeting, or what we also saw in the militarization of AI, targets for bombings are identified. There is no appeal. There is no uncertainty. There is no challenge to that process that is even possible. So, what would it mean to socialize or democratize? That if that would mean, you have this project on socialization, and one of the key insights is it's not just about who's in charge or who owns the thing. It's really a matter of, can we organize the social processes differently? And in the case of automated decision making, well, it doesn't seem to be really possible.
Yeah,
so,
yeah. I mean, I guess one of the aims of making these tools more diffuse is to spread or make responsibility disappear in a mm-hmm. sense. So responsibility for these decisions gets offloaded to the algorithms, right? Everything becomes a problem that AI can solve. Some people call this solutionism, like mm-hmm. Dan McQuillan calls it that. And I think that's a real problem for how far you can go with that as just a framework for reality, right? When if that becomes your model for how to deal with problems, is, you know, let's put it into the statistical probability output machine, then you've already kind of reduced the potential choices that are possible.
Sure, it's a technocratic dream come true, right? I mean, you replace politics, or, you know, even more emphatically, you replace praxis. You know, you replace it by a technology that is functioning according to a different logic.
But at the same time, you know, this comes up in the panel also from Matteo Pasquinelli, if AI is already a kind of socialized intelligence made private and then operationalized and imposed mm-hmm. on the division of labor, then it already contains this kind of antagonism of kind of the intelligence of labor within it, right? There's already kind of a hidden kernel of socialized knowledge of all of us, right? Sure. In these models, in these algorithms. So that should maybe push to a potential to liberate it and transform it, maybe for non-instrumental ends. One day, to hold on to that potential. I don't want to give that up outright, but it's hard for me to make that a realistic demand given the present moment.
But at the same time, I mean, it's an important point, I think, and could be connected to another thing I think that also Matteo mentioned, namely that AI is of course novel in many ways, but at the same time it also stands in a relation of historical continuity. Anna's book is about that as well, right? With earlier technologies that we have invented and that have enabled AI to emerge. So if those technologies were potentially at least subject to social democratic control, why should we now capitulate and sort of think, well, AI is beyond our reach? You know, we've produced this monster that we can't control anymore. Maybe that's also problematic mythology.
Yeah, I mean that's the problem of kind of transferring too much power to these mediums, these technologies themselves, as if they are beyond our comprehension. And the task is really to start comprehending them, thinking about them, expanding our capacity for judgment and critique. And I mean, one thing that came up in the conversation also with Roland Meyer and Anna Vernon-Nostoff was can we do this project of critique without having nitty-gritty kind of really technical understanding of the models of the transformer systems, of deep learning, of machine learning? Do we need to know everything about what happens? I mean, I think the answer was interesting. It was it was at a certain level, no. Like some things you do need to know, but you know, you don't need to understand how the radio works to understand a critique of radio, for instance, or
but you need to understand something about how the radio works, right? I mean, you cannot just treat it as a complete black box.
Exactly.
I have no clue what that thing is, but I don't like it.
Yes. So, and we shouldn't just let the understanding of artificial intelligence to kind of technical discussions.
True.
So we should also see it as a social project, as something for humanities scholars or up for political debate.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, there was an interesting point in the, I think in the Q&A where someone said, you know, what's the role of the humanities going forward? And Matteo, again, I think it was pointed out that, well, AI can't deal with metaphors. And, well, you know, at least there's something we can still do. But I was also wondering about another point, maybe not so much regarding us as humanities scholars, but more maybe as critical theorists. I mean, at the end, there was this real demand from the audience for, you know, showing us kind of paths of resistance and possibilities of, you know, be it hacking or, I don't know, attacking data centers or whatever. You know, what should we do?
Yeah.
How should we organize?
Yeah.
And I was wondering whether, you know, from a critical theory perspective, there's not two kind of views one could take on this. I mean, one is for sure to highlight the social struggles and the movements that are, you know, still maybe not fully developed, but there you can see them in a way that especially in also poorer communities and in the global south are forming against the kind of extractive logic of AI and tech companies. But there's another perspective that has to do more with the kind of crisis dynamic and the potential of collapsing under its own weight that might even be the more likely outcome. You know, I don't know if we can really organize the social forces to stop this, you know, massive and massively funded and politically embraced kind of, you know, AI avalanche that is coming at us. At the same time, I also wonder, you know, is it should we really hope for its collapse? I mean, is that something that is imminent? Is that something that we should wish for? Is it something that would open up more possibilities for resistance and critique than we could otherwise generate?
I mean, it's a great question. You know, a century ago, you know, there was this rise of kind of this what's called Zusammenbruch theory or collapse theory of capitalism, right? As capitalism was you know, causing wars or is at its peak, people said, actually, capitalism is on its way down. There's an imminent crisis to the logic of organic composition of capital. And that gives us the confidence and the truth of the future is in our hands, right? And we have to organize to be ready for that. Should we have a collapse theory of AI?
Yeah,
would that give us confidence? Would that help us to deal with the coming burst of the bubble? I'm not sure.
Yeah.
But I like thinking about it.
I mean, you know, collapses, you never know whether it comes, and it can also take very ugly forms.
Yes.
So in any case, we should continue the project of critique and resistance, because that's at least something we have in our hands and something that can hopefully shape the course of events and, you know, at least better prepare us for the moment of collapse if it comes, and to prevent it from turning things even uglier than they are now.
Thank you very much. On that note, I'd like to say thank you to Robin Selikates. And now you'll hear the conversation, Critique of AI.
Yeah. And many of the questions that we ask will be deepened and answered or thought further there.
Yeah.
Thanks, Jacob.
No problem. What is wrong with AI? And what is wrong with the way we talk about what is wrong with AI? That's what I want to discuss with all of you today. My name is Jacob Blumenfeld. I am a postdoctoral research fellow in philosophy at the Center for Social Critique at Humboldt University. And welcome to today's roundtable on the critique of AI. There's this joke about AI. I think Kate Crawford made it. It's neither artificial nor intelligent. Artificial intelligence is made out of real material resources, and it's real people behind the tasks that make it look autonomous. What do I mean by AI? I mean the research, design, and use of machine learning-based programs which run on large data sets that are used for solving optimization problems by taking advantage of statistical probability and predicting the most likely solution given the data on which it's trained. These tools try to automate decision-making given a specific objective. All the human labor and material nature that goes into these processes is rendered invisible. But I don't just want to focus on the technicalities of AI, though we'll discuss that too, but also on the ideology of AI, or even AI as a kind of ideology. How does AI function as an ideology of progress, automation, freedom, and control? Now, for social theorists, one key question is how to know exactly what we are criticizing about AI in the first place. Is it the thing itself or its effect on society? Is it the use of AI or the way it's made? Is it the technical system or the social relations in which it's embedded that make it harmful or beneficial to society? To find out how to criticize AI and how not to, I invited four experts on this topic. Allow me to introduce them now. On my left is Matteo Pasquinelli. He is the Associate Professor in Philosophy of Science at the Department of Philosophy and Cultural Heritage at Ca' Foscari University in Venice, where he's coordinating the ERC project AI Models. His book, The Eye of the Master, A Social History of Artificial Intelligence, won the Deutscher Memorial Prize. And you should look out for a new article of his at the end of this year called Theories of Automation, From Adam Smith to Artificial Intelligence. Next to Matteo is Anna-Verena Noftoff. She's a junior professor of ethics of digitalization at the Karl von Ozieski University of Oldenburg and co-director of the Critical Data Lab at Humboldt University and University of Oldenburg. She's the author of Kybernetik und Kritik, Ein Theorie digitale Regierungskunst, out with Surkamp today, I think. Yeah, congratulations.
Thank you.
And I just want to point out one article she wrote that I really liked. She wrote it with Felix Maszewski for Thesis 11 on the obsolescence of politics, rereading Günther Anders' critique of cybernetic governance and integral power in the digital age. Next to Anna-Verena is Roland Meyer. He's been the DADH Bridge Professor for Digital Cultures and Arts at the University of Zurich and the Zurich University of the Arts since July 2024. Roland's work as a media and visual culture researcher focuses on networked image cultures. He is the author of Gesichtserkennung from 2021 and Operative Portraits, Ein Bildgeschichte der Identifizierbarkeit vom Lavatur bis Facebook from 2019. And I want to point out one article that he wrote for the FAZ last year called Die Ästhetik des digitalen Faschismus. That's very helpful. Next to Roland is Rainer Mulhoff. He's a professor of ethics of artificial intelligence at the Institute of Cognitive Science and the Institute of Philosophy at the University of Osnabrück. He is affiliated as a researcher with the Einstein Center, Digital Futures in Berlin, and an associate member of the Collaborative Research Center, Effective Societies at the Free University of Berlin. He is the author of Künstliche Intelligenz und der neue Faschismus from Reclam last year. And also The Ethics of AI from Bristol University Press. Now, AI tools are everywhere today. They're in our phones, our computers, our universities, our workplaces. They're in our energy systems, our financial system, our justice system. Students, teachers, managers, doctors, translators use it. It'd be wrong to deny that people don't use it. People use it to find companions, right? To ask for advice, to come up with recipes, play games, to make images, movies, and memes. People use it to harass, to abuse, and exploit marginalized communities. They use it to write, to grade, to code, to annoy, to play, and the demand is only growing. AI requires massive amounts of data, energy, water, hardware, and cheap labor. The owners of AI companies are not only in bed with each other, boosting each other's stocks, but also in bed with the far right. AI should be criticized. It is being criticized. But how? Right? How should we criticize it? I want to briefly distinguish between a couple of various critiques of AI before we get to our speakers. You can make a philosophical critique of AI. Say, artificial intelligence is not really intelligent, right? Human consciousness can never be computable. There are some things that computers cannot do, right? That's why we should dismiss it. That's one strand. There can be a political critique of AI in terms of the political power of Silicon Valley, of the AI companies as unaccountable monopolies, right? Pushing undemocratic and authoritarian politics through their technologies. You can make an ecological critique of AI, the kinds of extraction of resources that are necessary to power these data centers. Every prompt you send demands a little bit more water, a little bit more coal and natural gas that's going to blow the carbon budget. You can make an economic critique of AI, right? De-skilling workers, exploiting labor, exploiting hidden labor across the world, right, to drive those automated cars. You can make a legal critique of AI, right? Violating copyrights, stealing our data, stealing the creative work of hundreds of cultural producers, right? You can have a cultural critique of AI. AI is flattening and leveling the creativity of cultural production, making it, you know, resemble a prose of, just what is it? Just cliche management speak, right? It's not this, it's this. Right? I'm interested in the critical theory approach of AI, right? What is the social form that makes AI possible? What is the society that makes AI the way it is? How are we already primed to use AI for these tasks? What kind of pressures are we under to adopt it? Are all of us under? It's very easy to criticize users of AI, but it might be more interesting to criticize the producers of it. So let's start. I have a question for all of you. It's going to be the same question, and then we'll spice it up a bit. The first question for you all, and we're just going to go down the list here, is how should we and how should we not criticize AI? That's it.
Who's going first?
Yeah, you want to go?
Me? Okay.
Yeah.
I had a question for you, Jakob, because in the sense that you made an overview of theories, and I think probably we are at the point of time when we need a kind of organic theory of AI or an organic theory of automation of technological development. So we are coming, you know, emerging from illustrious traditions. But probably it's time that we try to find a way to connect all of these disciplines also. And just because you mentioned this article that is coming out in a new version for historical materialism, I think there is this, not to mention some local know-how again, part four of Capital by Marx is this part in which he tries to produce, to build, to write himself a kind of organic theory, right? In which he says machines are produced where there are actually resistance to exploitation, where strikes are higher, and then you have this, you know, innovation coming up, you know, as a form of replacing jobs where strikes are high. But then he says, of course, these machines are built according to the logic of the division of labor. And then he defined also this idea that machines are the systems for the augmentation of relative surplus value. But just to mention that he tried himself, Marx, to have a vision in which you put like a sort of antagonistic standpoint theory of automation, a labor process theory of automation, and a value form theory of automation, if you want, right? And I think we are at the point where also today we should try to put these levels together, even if I think we forgot, you know, some kind of theories of automation we had already in the, for instance, the 18th century. And also they were discussing, by the way, how to indeed, what is the role of knowledge in the labor process. This was my answer to your initial remark.
You. Okay.
I can continue or I can pass the...
So thanks, first of all, for introducing us all to sort of the various dimension of or let's say the various ways in which we, I think, need to problematize existing AI system. I would definitely agree that we have to look at sort of the various social dimensions as well that you mentioned, including, you know, the way that AI systems are essentially based on the exploitation of labor, and, you know, the way that they are based on the exploitation of natural resources and so on and so forth. Maybe just to add to that, because I essentially agree with everything that you said in the beginning, What I look at, and this is probably also the time to pitch my book a little bit, what I might be able to offer to the discourse is maybe two forms of critique. The first one is an essentially Foucauldian view on the forms of power that are currently being exerted and that are very much immanent to AI systems. And I think given that sort of you also mentioned that the ubiquitousness of AI systems, you know, the normalcy with regard to how we use them as well, how they are sort of like really colonizing our everyday lives as well. As subjects, I think it's still very essential to ask the like very Foucauldian way of how we are being governed as subjects as well with regard to these environments. And maybe also expand that a little bit and not just, you know, speak of forms of governmentality, but of forms of environmentality as well, thinking of the increasingly immersive dimension of digital environment systems and so on. And then I would say, and that maybe also responds a bit to the question that you also asked, namely the question of how not to critique AI. I think, you know, if you look at the current discourse surrounding AI, there's plenty of people that exemplify how we should not critique AI, thinking of the very dominant superintelligence discourse as well, you know, that is being propagated by people such as Nick Bostrom, for instance, who, you know, was very, very influential in coining the term and essentially in as I said before, in propagating the term of superintelligence that is now being reproduced. You know, the whole superintelligence discourse is being reproduced by people such as Eric Schmidt, for instance. And there's this TESCRIAL acronym, as it has been suggested by Tim Jabru and Emil Torres, for instance, to point to these new and maybe not so new ideologies that play a huge role in the current discourse surrounding AGI, you know, ranging from transhumanism to rationalism to singularitarianism to effective altruism to long-termism and so on. And I would say that, you know, next to this focus on a potentially new form of governmentality critique that is inspired by Foucault, I think we also need to think of maybe a new form of ideology critique that pays attention to the development of these new ideologies that, you know, probably can also be reduced to very conventional forms of tech ideologies, including techno-solutionism and techno-determinism. But the thing is, these ideologies are very, very influential when it comes to shaping how existing AI regulations deprioritize existing harms that are part of AI systems. And they also shape, for instance, the current nationalist agenda of the United States, the AI accelerationist agenda they have. It's, I think, also, again, from Foucauldian perspective, it's very interesting as well to investigate as well how these terrestrial ideologies shape the discourses as well surrounding AI systems and how they sort of really enter into existing AI regulations, thinking of the AI safety discourse, for instance, that has been like really, really prominent as well, that is very closely connected to the terrestrial ideologies. So these are two dimensions that I would highlight.
Can you just define terrestrial real quick or...
That's an acronym, a bundle of ideologies, really. As I said before, that the term goes back to a paper that was written by Timnit Jabru and Emil Torres, where the essential hypothesis is that they say there's, you know, particular ideologies that are connected to the AGI discourse. And TESCRIAL stands for transhumanism, rationalism, transhumanism, extropianism, singularitarianism, cosmism, rationalism, effective altruism, and long-termism. So these are all these ideologies that, as they claim, they intersect. Yeah. They also build up on each other, I would say. Transhumanism is the first ideology that sort of like has influenced many of the ideologies that emerged in the aftermath. Yeah, so the essential hypothesis is that there's like new ideologies that influence the way that we talk about AI as well, existing AI systems.
Okay, so we already have a Marxist critique of AI, a Foucauldian critique of AI. Roland, you're next.
Could subscribe to both critiques and just add some
perspective from my point of view, and I think critical ideology is essential, and it's not just, and as you already hinted at, not just the ideology that is used to enforce these technologies and to scale them, but really the ideology within these systems. And I think one particularly important ideology is the ideology of scaling itself. So there is, in the 2010s, like a path that was taken in the development of AI models, especially by OpenAI, which was saying, okay, we need more and more data, we need more and more compute, and then some features will emerge that we cannot foresee. And that is our way to AGI. We don't have to curate the data sets. We don't have to steer the direction. We just have to have more raw compute and more data. And that's what has been done since then. And that has some, well, one can say impressive results. But the result is that we have a technology that is not a tool. And I think that is very important to stress also. Every critique that says, okay, it's a tool and it's used in the wrong way, I think is misguided, because these so-called foundation models, which are trained on, as we all know, vast amounts of data scraped from the web, stolen from the web, as one can say, they are not built for specific purposes, but they are built for no purpose at all, and then afterwards aligned to specific purposes. So that's what they do. And that, I think, in itself is a problem. And there is an inherent violence and brutality in that logic of scaling. And I could just stress two points of violence that I see, and as kind of striving for dominance also, that is built in this process of scaling. And the one is towards, and you already hinted at that, creative labor, which is appropriate on a massive scale. And it's not just stolen, it's devalued. So there is a quote from some Meta lawyers that I always found extremely impressive. When they were sued for copyright violation, they said to the authors of these books that were used as training data, yeah, your books as training data have no economic value because we stole billions of books, and every single book just kind of influences the model in such a tiny way, it's statistically irrelevant. So if we leave out your book, never mind. So that's a devaluation of cultural production that is not theft. Because if you steal something, you steal the value, right? But here you say, no, it's not valuable at all, but we steal it anyway. And I think that is a brutality that is now being performed very openly by these people like Sam Altman. And the other aspect, and we can talk about that more, I guess, is that whole scaling up of data centers, which we know is not only producing a massive carbon footprint, but really affecting like the local population in the areas these data centers are built. And I think the most horrifying example is the Colossus data centers in Memphis, which is built in a region that is primarily inhabited by black people, people of color, and it is fueled, or has been fueled at least, by gas turbines, which polluted the air, and people actually couldn't breathe because of a data center that is used to train Grok, the same AI model that is now used for deepfake porn on X. So that is a kind of very open and brutal violence that is now can now be seen in as an effect of this logic of scaling, which I would say is an ideology that is both a political ideology and economic ideology, and it is part of a certain trajectory of the development of the technology.
Just one follow-up question real quick. You said AI is not a tool and that it's not theft. Did you have an alternative in terms of AI not being a tool, then it is something else? Or it's not theft, then it's...
I would say it's a medium, but then we have again get in a media theoretical discussion. And I think it is, as I said, its main kind of effective devaluation rather than theft, I would say.
Great, thank you. Rainer?
Yeah, hi, also from my side. You are asking which forms of critique we should engage in and which ones we shouldn't. That's an interesting question that prompts me asking what is the normative principle by which you want to judge on that. And you already presented an impressive list of critique approaches, let's say, or layers of critique. When I entered this holy building on the stairs, I stumbled upon the Marx quotation in golden letters saying that the philosophers have only differently interpreted the world, and what really matters is that we change it. If this is also, if different forms of critique are also different interpretations of the world, if you allow me this stretch, then I would say, yeah, what matters might be how can we change the world? How can we, what forms of critique will unleash into transformation in the right direction? And what is the right direction, of course? And I would say that this totally depends on who you are talking to and which arena you are debating in. For instance, when you are talking about, when you are in politics and you want to fight for regulation of AI, it of course matters that you point out the vast environmental damages, the exploitation, the growing power imbalances of these companies, and so on. I'm not sure this has maximum impact in a debate among users, for instance, of AI, because users tend to foreground that it is comfy for them using it, or that it makes only a marginal environmental impacts when they prompt one time more ChatGPT. So that might be a different arena. And for instance, what in your list has been missing for me, but that has also already been brought up, but I'm also more on the track of ideology critique, because you cannot think of such a technology as AI without the millions of all of us users enabling the technology by daily producing data and also making the data available through our services and the services we choose on our devices to few companies that then use and extricate the data to make AI with it. And which is also an industry that then, or the vast amount of data and the things they want to do with the data then requires the worldwide extraction of resources, forms of labor, energy, and so on. Yeah. So, but still, it is AI. There is no AI without all of us as users. And this is why, for me, a Foucauldian perspective is very relevant in the critique of AI, because you need to understand how is subjectivity of people or of different people in different ways, but still subjectivity of different people shaped by the AI constellation in such a way that it is acceptable, wishable, whatever, desirable that we use AI. And I would say if you want to do such a Foucauldian critique, you cannot go without understanding AI as a phenomenon of ideologies in our societies. And these are not only the ideologies listed by the TASC-REAL acronym, which are more the ideologies of people within the AI scene, yeah, of researchers, business people in the AI scene. What I find interesting, and this is what I have tried to also lay out in this book, is that I see the ideological constellation of AI as some kind of a layered thing. Like, it's like an onion. The outer layers are the public discourse and the more shallow versions of these ideologies of AI in our discourse, such as AI can solve the impasse of school teachers or of people in elderly care, or like the techno-solutionism ideas that are circling in politics, but also these doomsday narratives. Yeah, AI will outpace human intelligence in a couple of years, and what are we doing then? And will China be first? And the EU has missed the train, and we need to deregulate AI so that we can have more digital sovereignty. This is all the ideological complex in the public layer. And below that is a layer that has more like clandestine ideologies among people in the AI scene, where you are then in transhumanism, a revival of eugenics. And Anna already mentioned them all. And I would say, as the nucleus of this onion, over the last 10 years, these ideologies have even been radicalizing in the form that they now form explicit political projects. Yeah, explicitly political projects. Yeah, so with the alliance between big tech and the alt-right or the new right movements in Europe, these ideologies start really articulating political visions and putting them in action. So I see this kind of layered building, and it's so important that to kind of map across the layers, yeah, which of the ideas circulating between Peter Thiel, J.D. Vance, and the alt-right, where does this correspond with theorems that are more in transhumanism or eugenics or some things Oxford philosophers would engage in, and so on. And then you can from there link these ideologies to the tropes in the public discourse and understand, okay, what is the connection between things we have in public discourse to these and so on. That's, for instance, an approach I find important to communicate in a public debate in such a way that we question our forms of subjectivation, yeah, the forms of how we are pressed into kind of complicity, yeah, how are we made complicit in this ideological discourse as users?
And even calling it AI is already part of the ideology in a sense, but it seems inescapable. I mean, I'm wondering, Matteo, how you would respond to this ideology critique, because I think your critique is a bit different, right? You're not really going on ideology critique. You're doing a division of labor critique.
Indeed, I was tempted to say 100% disagree, as in the kind of...
disagree.
It's kind of urban kind of tube interview that you see on social media. No, I've been, you know, reading Foucault and teaching Foucault a lot, but I think I take this as a form of self-criticism, so it's not a critic of somebody else. So I think it's part of a sort of self-criticism I went through myself, also emerging from media studies. I think today what we don't need and what we shouldn't do in terms of applying a methodology is like to study the impact of AI, the impact of technology, the impact of infrastructure. I think that we inherited a sort of a power discourse or an analytics of power that somehow is not able to show the real dynamics. I think what we need is a scientific theory of technological development that show how technology takes one form rather than the other. There is a logic behind it, and I think this logic can be mapped. And when we have a genetic model, when we can describe the development of technology genetically, we can also, I think, develop a kind of political discourse around it or a political response. So I think the studies of the impact are not enough. And there is some limitation also in the Foucauldian techniques of the self kind of approach. I don't want to sound too old school, but I think, as I said, continue a form of self-criticism. I notice myself how I've been applying, you know, probably a typical trope of Western thinking, you know, going to the analytics of this mechanism, going to the analytics of the division of labor. So having this focus on the analysis at the atomic level more than on the political synthesis. And then sometimes, you know, we travel to China, we encounter other formal analysis, we compare our study with what, for instance, Chinese scholars do, and we realize that our framework, our brain frame and methodology is not easy to translate into other cultural coordinates. And I think what we miss when we start from this sort of analytics of power is like this important bond that we, I think, erased sometimes in critical theory in between the individual, the community, the society, and the political institution. And we miss that. I think we don't have, even in this case, an organic understanding of what would be a political bond. And from this comes, indeed, I think, a sort of sometimes bias in the way we approach technology and our perspective. I will say something else maybe in a few seconds about this more when I reconnect more passages.
Any of you want to respond to that, or...?
Maybe just shortly, and that's also something that I'm trying to outline a little bit in my book. I think a path that we could envision as well is to pluralize critiques. Why limit ourselves to one critique, given, you know, the, I think, various forms of power and the different forms of power that AI systems reproduce? And, you know, and I don't mean this solely in a Foucauldian way of thinking about power, but maybe... we could sort of like combine a Foucauldian take with a more Marxist critique to be able to also, you know, on critical grounds, respond to the various forms of power that are associated with AI systems. maybe just maybe also as a rather open question.
I mean, Rainer asked this question about, you know, what are the ends of critique? Like different critiques for different ends. But my question is, you know, are there some ends we should not pursue? Are there some that are false paths or, you know, false things we shouldn't go down? And to focus on where the core of the question is. For instance, with ideology critique, let's say that the managers of these AI companies in 10 years change their minds and they become like progressive liberals and they're all good people then. What is it like? Does that change the critique? I mean, do we still have an ideology critique if their ideology is now on the right side?
Well, yeah, I mean,
but that would, yeah.
Sorry.
Roland. Now, maybe I can react to that because, as I wanted to point out, kind of very graphically, there is a certain ideology already built in the development. And as Matteo said, that development has taken a certain path, and there is a genealogy that can be written how that idea of AI, and there have been different ideas of AI, there is a continuity and there are shifts in that history, and it's complex, how that has shaped our last 10 years. And then we can ask, okay, what is it building on? What happened the 10 years before? And then we see, okay, it's a rise of platform capitalism and it's a production of vast amounts of data, user-driven datafication, people being subjectified as users of platforms. And now these AI systems are building on that. And that specific logic of foundation models, of building ever greater models with basically data scraped from the web, data produced by what we would call all of us, whoever that is, that is like a next level in the economic logic of these platform companies. So now they can use not only the surveillance data about users, but also all the content and use that for pattern recognition and use it for producing more content and so on and use it to train their models. And the ideology kind of springs from that business model. It's not that what people like Musk think or not think. And I'm a bit hesitant about how important all these kind of fringe ideologies are. I think it's important to study them, but to see what they are the expression of. And maybe then I'm a very classic Marxist. I think they are expression of modes and conditions of production. And production in that sense has been mainly distribution because platform companies are mainly companies that organize distribution rather than production. But now they also produce the content they distribute via these AI models. And that is a new step. And there, everything else is kind of part of that dynamic, in my view. But that's a bit reductive, I would say. But I think we can learn something from tracing that genealogy that goes back to the beginnings, both of platform companies in the 2000s and the whole discourse of big data, which is happening at the same time and says, okay, we don't need causality, we just need correlation. We can dive into these big seas of data. We don't need any science anymore. That was already like the AI discourse now in its kind of first version, but they didn't have like the power to really enforce it in the same way. And now they have these models which make it more plausible that big data is the solution to everything.
I think it's really important that the ideology of AI is not only what Peter Thiel and Mark Zuckerberg and the likes are thinking and saying. And if they change their minds or present themselves differently, that does not make any difference. But the ideology of AI is much bigger. It's like it's a huge constellation of ideas, tropes, beliefs, discourses, but also practices, problems, material impasses, and so on, where all of us are part. You can also add colonial legacies of global power imbalances, certain developments in how labor and production are organized, and so on. And for instance, you can see the ideology of AI when you observe how stunningly obvious it is to many politicians in Germany that we should invest millions in AI technology for high schools to automate grading. there is ideology at work, because how could this get so obvious to so many overnight in a way? Yeah, this is, and this is far away from Peter Thiel or whoever. And we should not personalize the problem of AI ideology on certain like Silicon Valley bosses. And neither should we Americanize the problem. Yeah, that we are kind of doing this othering, it's all happening there in Silicon Valley and the next fascism will happen over there, and how we can watch from here with a popcorn emoji. But we are in this as well. We have that here as well. We are playing part in this ideological complex. Maybe we are not the epicenter of this. I'm not sure. Let's see. But this is so important that this is not only like... what the tech bosses say is only a crystallization of processes that are bigger than they are. Because, for instance, Peter Thiel was saying what he's saying already 20 years ago, even writing it down, yeah? But nobody paid attention. And now we are focusing on Peter Thiel. Maybe in 5 years we are focusing on somebody else, on things they were saying 20 years ago. So this is, you cannot pin it on certain persons. That's the important thing.
Mateo?
Yeah, as I want to point to the fact that at the beginning, in your brilliant overview, you didn't describe at which point we are of this technological curve. If you are at the beginning, or if you are at the end, if you are, you know, at the beginning of an economic growth of prosperity, or at the end, maybe close to the bubble that will burst. And I think this is also a question. So it was an open question for me. I don't know where we are exactly, but I have the feeling there is a sort of this aggressiveness of the AI ideology, their transhumanism, their accelerationism, the way they are also try to militarize the discourse, the ideology of AI, I think is also a symptom of the fact that some of these monopolies of the Silicon Valley perceive that they are at the end, at the point of saturation of the sphere of distribution and circulation. I interpret it like that. I interpret this political aggressiveness as a sort of weakness of the project they had. And here we should discuss indeed what is the view that we have of the geopolitics of AI, the relation that we have in the United States between private companies and the state, and compared to what is the other opponent and competitor, that is basically China, de facto state monopoly on the data of the population, a kind of opponent and that is quite difficult to emulate. So I think we have also to maybe bring the discussion at this geopolitical level in which we have a different role or a non-role for Europe in between this different attempt to regulate. And this is also my contribution to the ideological critique, because I follow, you know, the debate that are emerging closely. And it's very fascinating, for instance, the way Peter Thiel has been, you know, reviving the idea of misinterpreting the ring of the catechon, but mentioning Carl Schmitt, mobilizing even Carl Schmitt in the new political agenda, and using a quite a sophisticated language to show how, for instance, for them, for this AI monopolies, the new form of the Antichrist in their language is basically social democracy, China, the environmental movement, Greta Thunberg, because they are all, for them, obstacles to this project of a basically privately run state power. And so I think these are like an interesting aspect of some part of the ideological production connected to AI, but also, in my view, maybe a symptom of the weakness of the West, of the West front in the making of this new technology, to which maybe we should go to the point we discussed earlier, that is, what would be a project of socialization or resocialization of knowledge, of intelligence.
We'll get later. We'll get there in a second. You did mention that we need a scientific theory of technological development. I just want to ask a little bit more about the technical side of AI. Do we need to know the tech inside and out to have a real proper kind of theory of AI, to have a real proper critique of it? Do we need to know the history of the technological development to know what it exactly is that is reproducing these structures of exploitation, surveillance, domination? Or can we criticize it without that insider knowledge? Any thoughts?
I mean, I think I think we need strongly an understanding of the technical function of the mechanism. One of the problems in teaching AI or doing AI studies, critique of AI, is the fact that we are not very familiar with the statistical technique that are at the core of AI models rendering, you know, cultural heritage, language, our image production. There are technique of multidimensional analysis that would be, and vectorization that would be relatively easy to teach in university classes, right? But we don't do that. And I think this is also, I mean, part of the work I tried to do in the past is position AI in the development of techniques that are basically cultural techniques absorbed by mathematics, statistics, even physics in between the 19th century and 20th century. And interesting for us, for any history of science and technology, how these techniques got automated at a certain point with psychometrics, with artificial neural networks in the 50s. And today they are this fantastic tool to render collective knowledge and collective intelligence. But I think, yes, we need to understand how they work.
I would certainly agree with that. And that's also why I did my own book, is because I look back at the history of cybernetics to better understand as well. And, you know, again, in a Foucauldian view of how we are being governed in the present. And there's few reductionisms that, you know, you can actually trace back to the origins of cybernetics, including the way that, you know, cyberneticists have thought about the relationship between man and machine, between the mind and the computer, for instance, how they thought about politics in a very systemic manner. And the political, you know, as a network to be governed by information flows, essentially. Those are, I think, ideas that still matter when we understand the digital present. But then generally, I would say the question is also, of course, do we need to have a very specific understanding of different AI systems? Do we need to know the difference between generative AI or machine learning? And then I would say, well, I'm not so sure, because sometimes I think the difference is not so huge as it might first appear. And then you can as well, and again, I would say, you know, relating that back to cybernetics, for instance, many of these technologies are based on very similar mechanisms, on a very similar logic, including, you know, predictive analytics, the way that these systems use past data to predict the future or some form of the future, the way that they sometimes even determine the future. And also the way that they, you know, reduce the subject to data subjects, for instance. There I would say there's also similarities that are being shared by many of these current forms of AI, where I would say, you know, the differences are very superficial in a way, and it sometimes suffices to look at the broader logics that these systems are being based on.
I think the level of detail of technological knowledge you need is based on what questions you're asking and what kind of critique you want to raise. But for example, if you want to know, which interests me, how AI image generation models represent history or historical images, how they distort history, for example, you have to think about something like vectorization, for example, and you have to get at least a grasp of what that is, what latent spaces are, whether they still play a role in your AI image generation models or not, which is a very complex discussion I had with computer scientists. So you have to get some knowledge, not at really technical knowledge in my case at least, but a knowledge about the preconditions, also the epistemological preconditions. What is it based on? What does it presuppose? And what are the possible implications? And that's about the algorithms or the kind of machine learning logic that are in place, but also about things like data sets, for example. So what kind of data is used? How is it structured? Or especially it's not very structured. So what does it mean that it's not very structured? So I think these kind of questions are necessary if you want to have a kind of more specific critique. And the more specific your critique becomes, the more detail you have to have in terms of technological knowledge. But as a media cultural scholar, I'm always very limited in my view, and I have to check with people who know better that I don't do the most blatant mistakes when I describe something.
I'm working a lot with high school teachers in teacher training formats and stuff, and what I observe is that AI has for long been allocated as a subject for the computer science classes, and not, for instance, for social science or philosophy subjects at school, which I find totally wrong. And a related observation is that in the public discourse, as soon as we call for more technical understanding about AI, like the usual narrative is that we need to understand AI in order to criticize it. And understanding AI is then a purely technical thing. Yeah, with this idea that I need to understand AI is suddenly turned from a socio-technical constellation where there's power, people exploited, data misused, or misused and societal impact manifested. Suddenly it is turned into a question of how does backpropagation work? What is a convolutional neural network versus a support vector machine? And the thing is, I do not need to understand the difference between a diesel engine and a normal petrol combustion engine to make the critique that this is that driving these cars to the extent we are doing it is damaging our environment. And as little as I need to know the physics of combustion engines, I need to know the algorithms of AI. And I would say it actually obfuscates the critical view or viewpoint if you get too much on this tech insight talk level of understanding AI, because that has its very elegant mechanisms of completely blinding away and obfuscating the societal embedding of the technology. Yeah, that you are then talking about abstract mathematical or computer science terminology and problems and so on that are hard to understand. I'm a mathematician by training, and you completely blind away how this actually works as a business model, how much intelligence gets into how to hook the users to produce the data, how much intelligence goes into how to influence regulation, how to find regulatory loopholes, how to do that data-intensive business model despite data protection regulation by exploiting certain gaps in it, how to foster a big international scheme of corporate collaborations that enables you to exploit the resources, the labor forces in the global south, the flows of material resources and so on. That all gets away when in the common way the question of let's understand AI is being framed. And this is a big problem because that demobilizes critique of AI and kind of makes or constitutes a monopoly on AI for the tech bros, yeah, for the people who understand or putatively understand the technology instead of all of us having a say. And that's why I think it should be an integral part of understanding and critiquing AI that we find suitable vocabularies describing the functioning of AI, which are not purely technical vocabularies, but socio-technical vocabularies, political vocabularies, vocabularies with such terms as power or strategies or profit interests, or maybe how do you psychologically envision the average user so that the user can easily be hooked by a certain user experience design or interaction design. All this is part of AI.
I'd like to go a bit deeper into kind of each of your specialties in your own work, further on this critique of AI question. I'll just start with Roland. In your work, you tend to make a relation between the aesthetic production of AI images and a kind of fascist aesthetic. That's a very difficult argument to make, that there's like in the form of the image itself, there's a political content. So I'm just wondering, how do you make this argument?
Well, I'm not the only one making this argument. It has been made by others, and it's exemplified like every day on X.com and Truth.social and whatever. Also Instagram. I think there are different elements to that. I think the one that I already mentioned, the question of devaluation of creative labor and the brutality that is part of that, the very open brutality that is now being visible, for example, on a platform like X.com, where you can ask Grok to nudify any image of a woman and of children also, and this kind of promise of power over other people's images and likenesses and bodies, ultimately, that comes with this technology. So it is a technology that is already a kind of metaphor for power and domination, and also, now I would say, maybe even a tool, or made into a tool to exert power. But I think there is also another dimension, which I stressed in different essays. And this comes for me down to like three things. The one is that there is a kind of nostalgic dimension to AI images, insofar that they are not only trained on vast amount of images from the past, because training data is always data from the past, but they also manifest a certain model of history, one could say, and that is that all the past is a resource for visual patterns, for styles, for aesthetics, for vibes that are completely dehistoricized, that can now be recombined into these kind of timeless fantasy worlds, and that you see all the time. So you have ideas of a certain historical epoch, but it's just what Jameson called pastness. It's an aesthetic idea of a past that never was. And you can see that every day, for example, on the Instagram account of the Department of Labor. So if you haven't seen that, check it out. It's horrible. And so there is this certain view of the past as a resource to be extracted, and that can be recombined to this nostalgic dream worlds. There is a question of a certain genericness that comes with an affirmation of bias, of stereotypes, of cliches, of sexist stereotypes, of racist stereotypes. And I think that is very much also built into the technology insofar, and it's a very, oversimplification, but basically AI image generation is kind of pattern recognition in reverse. And it's based upon techniques of pattern recognition and image recognition that were kind of reverse engineered. So instead of just labeling images, like we have hundreds of labels of images of animals, and you label all the cats, now you prompt a label and it produces the image that best matches your label. And what is the image that best matches your label? It's a stereotype. It's a thing that's most cliche-like that everybody expects when you prompt a cat. And with a cat, that may not be a problem. But with a family, of course, it's a problem. With a woman, it's a problem. With a man, it's a problem. So you get these over-simplified, extremely legible stereotypes in the very logic of prompting and the very logic of matching labels with dominant patterns extracted from vast amounts of visual data. And from a right-wing perspective, that's a pro. That's something they want. That is something they affirm. And you can see also that, especially in questions of gender representations, how much they affirm it. And the long-standing critique of bias is then turned around kind of the bias is actually what they want, and what they call bias is a liberal bias. So that is everything that is aiming at regulating these technologies or trying to mitigate the bias that is built in there. And it's now also a policy of Trump, who is has an executive order against woke AI that is a direct reaction to Google's Gemini image generator, which produced images that were not expected, like images of Asian female popes via something they call shadow prompting. So they didn't change the stereotyping and cliche logic of the model, but they changed the interface so that when you prompted pope, it would say, okay, you want an Asian female pope, so here you have it, and that's more diverse. And the reaction to that is to say, no, we don't want any woke AI, we want the kind of true thing, and the true thing is that which already always produces stereotypes. And the last thing, maybe cut it short, these images are optimized to trigger reactions on social media. And it's not only that the training data they are trained on is like the vast amounts of images that are already aggregated by platform companies, but it's also that the reactions of platform users, the social media users, are used to fine-tune these models to make them aesthetically pleasing in a very certain way to align them to certain aesthetic expectations that are the expectations of platform users. And especially, and one can trace it and has been traced, a certain group of platform users that predominantly kind of reflect their aesthetic and ideological tastes in these images and their aesthetics. And that is mostly white middle class men from North America, actually. So there is like very different dimension where these images are already optimized for certain, I would say, reactionary, authoritarian, and even fascist tendencies. And it's not a misuse of these technologies when people like Trump and Musk and whoever are using them as this kind of slot machines, because that's in a way what they were built for.
That's their function.
If the function of a system is what the system does, it is their function, and you can trace how it came to be to function that way.
Anna, I just want to ask you a question on cybernetics. Is there a meaningful distinction between understanding cybernetic governance and AI and kind of a critique of AI? Or do you subsume AI into kind of a cybernetic governmentality?
I wouldn't subsume it, I think, directly, but I would say there's a few linkages between cybernetic governance and cybernetic governmentality and digital governmentality. There's this media theoretical premise that has been shared by many media theorists for a few years now already, such as Erich Hörl, Klaus Piers, Dieter Mersch, and others, who trace the origins of current digital governmentalities back to the origins of cybernetics. And I would certainly agree with them, because if you look at the origins of cybernetics, then there's a few motifs, dispositives, narratives, also reductionisms that occur throughout the 40s, 50s onwards that still play a role, I think, with regard to the question of how we are being governed in digital societies. What you get there, for instance, and that has been very influential for the development of AI, for instance, the brain model by McCulloch and Pitts, who came up with the first idea of a neural network, in a sense, the McCulloch-Pitts neuron, that was essential work really for the history and for the development of artificial intelligence. And from that also, you get the analogy between the brain and the computer. That's, of course, still very influential for the way that, you know, ideologically we speak and think about AI currently. Then, as a second motif, maybe, there's a way of paralleling the human and the machine, maybe in drawing sort of like analogies, maybe to the point where cyberneticians have defended an identity between the man and the machine. You get a very post-political mindset that I think still plays a huge role for understanding, for instance, how Elon Musk, for instance, portrays his work with regard to the Department of Government Efficiency, which is, of course, you know, embedded in a deeply political agenda. But the way that he portrays the Department of Government Efficiency as being more effective, more efficient through an agenda of acceleration than, you know, conventional processes of politics. And the idea of designing a system that might be able to offer an alternative, you know, to a very sort of like conflict-based conception of the political. That's, I think, also part of the cybernetic mindset, especially the political cybernetics that have developed throughout the 60s and 70s by people such as Carl Deutsch and David Easton. So there's a few, I think, linkages that you can draw on that play a huge role, I would say, for understanding digital forms of governance, but also the way that we conceive of technology. That's also very, very, very important narrative throughout the history of cybernetics, is to portray technology as something that's essentially neutral, right? In one sense, but at the same time, they also defend, of course, the hypothesis that technology can no longer be understood in terms of a means and relation, which is a bit paradoxical, because they sort of like come up with both of these hypotheses, which are, however, inherently contradictory. And it's kind of the same contradiction that you also see with people, you know, that are sort of like at the center of the AGI race. Think of Sam Altman, for instance, who says essentially the same thing. You know, on Monday he says technology is only a tool, and on Tuesday he's like, well, it's, you know, we have created a godlike entity. And there's a few contradictions, I think, that also are very have been very consistent since the beginning of cybernetics.
That reminds me of a tweet that Sam Altman made last week, which I had to screenshot. He said, "I'm very excited about AI, but to go off script for a minute, I built an app with Codex last week. It was very fun. Then I started asking it for ideas for new features, and at least a couple of them were better than I was thinking of. I felt a little useless, and it was sad." And that's the end of the tweet. It's kind of Promethean shame, right? From the founders of OpenAI, very clearly kind of transferring power, agency, and the labor that goes into it to the machine itself. This kind of takes me to Matteo. The novelty of your perspective is to have a labor theory of automation, or one of the novelties. Instead of focusing on the mind, a machine analogy, you know, the point is to focus on the intelligence of labor that's captured through these machines. So can you just kind of tell me, what does the labor theory of automation do for us? What is it?
Yes, this was probably my attempt in the book, The Eye of the Master, actually reviving an old theory. It's not my theory. Yeah. That we need to see the development of technology from another point of view that is not simply the point of view of labor or capital. The labor theory of automation was the theory of automation for Adam Smith, Charles Babbage, and Karl Marx to start with. Of course, Marx took another direction, but they started from the analysis of the labor process to see how the design of the machine imitated somehow quite perfectly the design of the labor process, of the cooperation of labor after many, you know, routines and so on. We could call it labor theory of automation even today, but clearly AI is this crystallization of collective labor, collective knowledge, collective intelligence, so more of a social cooperation across the whole society. But I think AI itself in its infrastructure is a sort of demonstration of this theory of automation in which automation emerges from below, because clearly in the basic architecture of AI, you have a data set from a data center built with the data produced by our activities, could be labor activities, everyday routine, on which an algorithm upon this data extract a model to automate other kind of skills and tasks later on. So I think it's clearly that AI today is an imitation of our social cooperation, and society and AI are in a sort of symbiotic relation. AI without society will never be possible. This is part of the limitation of AI. We know that AI models need to be updated, that they suffer of model collapse, they need fresh data, as in the past, machine needed living labor. So it is also part of the critique to be done of the ideology of AI is the fact that no machine can be autonomous and AI will never be autonomous, because also it's clearly the crystallization of cultural heritage history, but history continues. So this machine, they have to be updated. But anyway, the labor theory that I also wrote in the book is partial, because we need other theories, the one that you mentioned at the beginning, to integrate that. We need a value theory of automation, seeing how what are the effects on the chain of valorization. And we have to study also the conflicts, the antagonists, the friction that are produced by these machines when they are introduced in different contexts. So you had the book of Dan McKillen here on the table, just an example of an author or scholar that just want to probably stress that point, that where machines, where AI reach a point of real conflict with society. I can continue on the labor theory of automation if there are more interest on the
book. I mean, I'm interested in actually this last point on the antagonisms, the contradictions between AI and democracy and anti-fascism. Raina, your book is on AI and fascism and the new fascism. I'm wondering, first of all, how do you conceptualize the connection between AI and the new fascism, and also resistance to it?
Nothing more easy than this.
2 minutes.
Yeah, the mission of the book is manifold, and for instance, regarding fascism, it's I think so important that we do not reserve fascism, the term, for something that happened in the past, watchful that this can happen again. And when I say this can happen again, it's also important that it might take different shapes, or that it might not be an identical repetition, and it might look slightly different and still be fascist. That is that is was one of the, or that is maybe the justification of why call it fascism and not the new authoritarianism or something. I mean, there are many linkages between the two. And for instance, you can point out why AI technology can easily be instrumentalized by fascist politics. Roland Meyer did important work on this. Others did important work on this. I have also for years pointed out why AI technology is a great tool if you want to discriminate on people, if you want to increase social inequalities, if you want to exploit people, if you want to kind of do all the nasty things that you can do when you make predictions about people and so on. And the mission here and the point that we need to add to this state of debate is, in which way is the linkage between AI and fascism not only opportunistic or and not only instrumental? And this is what I try to achieve by looking at the ideologies that are currently mobilizing AI. AI not as merely a technology or something that happens on computer, but AI as a political, cultural, and material constellation. And we have been talking about this here for a while. And we can see that the AI industry, so the power centers of AI, like the people doing AI, extracting profits and power positions from doing AI, that this is currently shaping a big kind of alliance with at least ultra-right or alt-right politics in the US. And the idea was that we should point out that this is not only opportunism, but it has a ideological roots or common ideological roots between alt-right and what is underway in terms of ideas and philosophies and ethics in the AI community. So we talk about what Peter Thiel and Sam Altman are thinking, and I previously said we should not limit it to this. And this is the complicated thing. It is a broader constellation, constellation of ideologies, which runs the risk of damaging our democracies and Rechtsstaats. What is that in English? Yeah, it's a hard problem translating Rechtsstaat to English. Yeah, constitutionalism. Let's say constitutionalism. And this is the idea is that, I think what is important to know is that after 10 or 15 years of the big tech industry extracting all the data and resources that you can extract in, let's say, on a democratic or more or less democratic platform, yeah, like the data was in the beginning mostly taken from consumers or from businesses. And then there has been this kind of post-colonial constellation of the extraction of energy and resources in the past. But now we are at a point where public, where consumer data or data that you can acquire commercially is not enough. Basically, you have it all. You need new data sources in the AI industry. Who has data that is not yet captured and that is even well-structured? Maybe you look at the educational system, at the health systems, at the states, at the administration. So the turn to the state is first of all an idea to colonize new resources of data that has not yet been harvested by that industry. Then we are now in the midst of everybody talking about when will the AI bubble burst. So it is also the financial, like financing AI and AI profits and AI power by venture capital might come to an end. So it is also of relevance to find new funding sources, and the state running or paying the AI industry to run its administration would be a comparatively secure funding source compared to venture capital that might burst at some point in the near future. So there is ample interest of the AI industry to actually not only cooperate with the state, but, and this is now the proposition, actually merge or take over the state, let's say. And Francesca Bria has pointed it out so very well that what happened in the US in the last year is that big tech companies have become the operating system of that administration. Yeah, you do not cancel tens of thousands of contracts of administrative workers without what we, how are you, do you want to substitute them? And they are being substituted by these processes now being run on technological platforms. Yeah, there are the big technologies by Palantir. There is Immigration OS by Palantir for the ICE. There are other Palantir products for the other government branches of the US. There is the government clouds of Amazon and of Microsoft. They have contracts worth billions of dollars. And the US American state is de-sovereignizing itself by transferring sovereignty over its administrative procedures to this industry. And at the same time, this industry knows very well that they cannot run this business the next 10 years without conflicting, for instance, with environmental standards. Yeah, the projected energy use of the industry is so vast. It will be so explosive. Like, scientific estimates say that data centers need 5 to 10 times more energy. Eric Schmidt says they will need 100 times the energy of today in 2030. That is only 4 years from now. So they know very well that in the framework of the current kind of international state of affairs in between democratic countries and regulation and environmental protection, they will not be able to increase their profits in the way they want to do. And so they need to turn to anti-democratic and even anti-rule of law, so anti-constitutional politics, to keep their businesses running. It is kind of the conatus, the inertia of these forms of business models, that they are now at the point where they conflict with democracy and constitutionalism, and therefore need to undo with democracies and constitutionalism. And this is what we see, and this is kind of where I see that linkage.
Before we turn to the questions from the audience, is there a potential for resistance?
Sorry, I omitted that part of the question.
No, but it's okay if there's not. I mean, I'm open to both. But, like, you know, can you reappropriate these mediums, these tools, these technologies? Can you play with them? Can you experiment? Can you break them? Right? Can you disrupt them? Can you feed it false data? Do you have to build your own? Can you socialize them?
Sorry that I forgot actually about that part of the question. And I think it would be very interesting to have a whole round on this because, I mean, I think this is a hard, hard job. And who am I to give the one silver bullet answer? I think critiquing this formation on different layers and with different methods of critique geared for each individual arena where you bring this critique is important, and I play only one maybe key in this whole kind of range of keys that you could play. My mission is kind of enlightenment work. Like, I want to, I would say I do public Aufklärung. I don't know.
Education?
Yeah, education is a transitive verb, while Bildung and Aufklärung is something you need to do yourself. So I think it is one track, but only one track to meddle with public discourse on AI, to be a voice that criticizes or that shows people that all these ideas rest on false assumptions or on very dangerous assumptions. But this is certainly not the only strategy that we should rely on. And this is why we should make a full round and probably maybe even extend the question to more people who are not here on the stage.
Yeah, maybe. I think it's important to think about different arenas of resistance. And I think the university is a central one because, as you pointed out, institutes of education have become providers of data for these companies. They are really in the kind of spotlight of their ambitions. And if I look at where I am in Zurich, which is a hub for technology companies, Palantir is there, Meta is there, they are all there. And the ETH and the University of Zurich and the other institutions are very open in embracing what they call AI on very different levels. And I think that is a struggle that we all have to fight within our institutions, within the university, for example, to really make a case against a kind of naive adoption of these technologies as supposedly tools, as supposedly solutions for problems that are not yet identified. And that is what you see. So you get a lot of money when you propose, okay, I'll do something with AI here, and now let's see what would be the problems we can solve. And it's not that we have a problem, like, for example, our website cannot be understood by the students, and now we make a better website, but rather, yeah, maybe we have a chatbot, and that can help students to navigate the website. But the idea is first to have a chatbot, and then they see, okay, what can we use it for? I won't go into more details, but these are like the dynamics now at play in institutions, and I think we all are, or many of us are part in institutions, and maybe have a say or even try to intervene and also in communication with students to raise awareness about these dynamics.
I can only echo, to be honest, what has been said already. I think we need to not just pluralize critiques, but also think of how we can pluralize our approaches to resistance as well. And I think, you know, one method can, of course, be to engage in like public Aufklärung, also regarding the discourse analysis, deconstruct the myths that are being propagated by the AGI industry and so on. But also, you know, make visible these struggles that are already occurring of those people who are resisting the construction of data centers, for instance, in the global south. You know, make them more visible, talk about them, also talk more about them than, about the AGI discourses, although I still find the sort of deconstruction of these discourses to be very essential. But this is so essential because they are so dominant. So, and then, of course, also, you know, look at the legal tools that we have, look at the discussions that we currently have with legal theorists on how we can come up with a better legal system that is more responsive to the forms of power that is being exerted by these systems. So there's also, you know, debates going on in this area. And I think it's also very important to come up with a different sort of also different legal system that is able to respond to the correlative nature of the data injustices that occur. To echo Rainer as well, I think we need to have like a huge debate about this, and, you know, bring many people into the debate. And, you know, because it's not, you know, our role here as people sitting here to have a singular homogeneous answer to that.
But yeah, I agree. Also, I second what has been just said. I would like to go back to what Rainer explained very well, that is the need of these companies of the state, you know, basically to catch up with, I think, a crisis of their economic model. And I think the issue is like what we mentioned, or we promised at the beginning. The basic question would be how you socialize a monopoly, how you re-socialize a monopoly of collective knowledge that is built basically on privatization of collective knowledge. And I think there is here a kind of crisis of the Western constitution, starting from the United States, in which you have this form of steep privatization of collective knowledge into the hands of very few companies. But still, I think what's happening right now is the fact that, as we know, that neoliberalism has never been this autonomy from the political, that's been always in need of the state. I don't repeat this because I think ordoliberalism has been studied quite intensively here, also thanks by our friends and colleague Quinn Slobodian in his books. But I think the issue is, how do we resocialize? And is AI going to stay as a general infrastructure of knowledge governance or disappear? And if it will stay, probably in the future, will be considered almost a state utility, will be maybe, I don't know, public data center. I think if you see the development that happened in other parts of the world, because we've been focusing, I think, on Western capitalism. If you look at the constitution of data center in China, that's also a phenomenon we should follow, because there clearly there is a sort of crystallization of a de facto state monopoly on knowledge that I'm not sure will disappear very soon. While in the West, I see a sort of balkanization of powers happening in this respect. I didn't answer the issue of resistance.
I mean, the question of how do you socialize the privatization of generalized intelligence, I think, is an open question for all of us. Yeah. If the data that powers AI systems comes from the labor of us all, then it's pretty obvious what we need to do. We need to go on strike. Thank you very much. Yeah, if you want to stick around and discuss, we're here.
Critical theory in context.